I think when you're in public art, you have this audience that are part of everyday experience for them,
mm-hmm.
and they may not even know your name, but I know it's out there working. They walk by it, they like it or dislike it or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's so different than a captive audience.
Hey everyone, this is Julie Wake from the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod. Welcome to Season 6 of the Creative Exchange Podcast. We continue our celebration of artists, arts leaders, and the brilliant minds shaping the creative landscape. From painters to performers, writers to visionaries, we delve into the diverse world of creativity to discover what it truly means to be an artist in today's dynamic and ever-evolving landscape. I hope you'll join me on this creative journey. And if you like these conversations, leave a rating or a review. Share with a friend. Help us shine a bright light on our creative corner of the world here on Cape Cod. We'd like to thank our sponsor, William Ravis Real Estate, as the official real estate company of the Arts Foundation. We'd like to thank our sponsors, the Cape Cod Melody Tent, the Kelly Foundation, the Woods Hole Foundation, and the Cape Cod Foundation. We couldn't do it without your support. We'd like to thank Bank 5 and the Cooperative Bank of Cape Cod. Thank you for supporting the arts. Get ready for an artistic adventure with a twist as we dive into the enchanted world of David Phillips, the American sculptor and master of site-specific art. Picture this, larger-than-life architectural wonders featuring stone, cast bronze, lush greenery, and shimmering pools of water. It's a creative fusion of art and nature that will leave you spellbound. But there's more to Phillips than meets the eye. He's a connoisseur of Eastern aesthetics, and his work is like a magical journey through the wonders of nature and illusion. His sculptures tell stories of geometric shapes playfully dancing through the landscape. So join us as we explore David L. Phillips, nature-inspired forms that exist at the intersection of eternity and the human desire to shape and organize the world. It's a whirlwind of creativity that you won't want to miss. David, thank you for having us here in Sandwich in
this
beautiful, very busy looking studio in Sandwich.
It's busy. I work here almost 7 days a week, with the breezeway connected to the house, I'm sometimes out here in my bathrobe and checking out what I've done the night before and see if I like it, you know.
Right. So that's so interesting. So your process, so this is like you would come in super early in the morning, start working on something, or you work into the night. What's kind of your process?
Well, it's all different schedules, different days. I mean, some days I'm really interested in pursuing something I started.
Yeah.
And sometimes I've looked at what I started the previous day, or already it's in the trash, and so I look forward to just going into the studio and, okay, whatever happens in the studio today is what I'm going to do. Most of my career has been in public art, so mm-hmm. I was doing mostly what I had already proposed, and it was all physical and kind of focused.
Yeah.
I'm doing a switch now, and that I'm just trying to discover what I'm going to do next. So I treat the best days are like that.
Yeah.
That I don't have a lot of other commitments for the day or interruptions. Sometimes shut the phone off and I tell Peggy, if we're having lunch together, what time will it be? I'll join you in the house for lunch.
That's so smart.
But sometimes I cook my own lunch. I'm not saying I'm tough.
No, but like letting her know, this is your job.
Our marriage began with me working in Somerville, and Peggy had a job in Boston, so she would either take the subway in or I would often drive her into work, and then that whole day she did her work and I did my work, and then we'd meet at night back in Cambridge. But now, with the house being so close,
yeah,
I'm trying to kind of recreate some of that feeling that I'm going to work, even though my commute's 10 seconds long.
Right.
You know, so yeah. It's been a challenge to kind of recreate that with a studio that's so close to where you live.
Yeah.
And
there's lots of pros and cons, I bet.
There's pros and cons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, tell me a little bit about, I was reading an interview that you did recently, and you were quoted as saying, you were determined not to get a so-called real job. I love that.
I think that's true. Early on in high school, I took a correspondence course through the mail, and I started it actually in junior high school, and it was called art instruction, and my mother paid for it, and I mostly disliked it because one lesson could be interesting to me, like perspective, and I was learning how to draw, and others would be about painting. I enjoyed that, but then there are other whole lessons that I'd have to complete before they sent the next one, like repetitive design. And I remember one of them was design some wallpaper. Well, here I am, a junior high school boy. That's not what you're interested in.
No.
And
the concept, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But bit by bit, I slugged through it and finished the course and got a certificate and all that. And I was very relieved to.
Was that your introduction, your first introduction to art?
Not really. I was always scribbling, crayons, pencil.
Yeah.
I was doing drawings. I was kind of a kid in the neighborhood that didn't play sports, but was always drawing, kind of kid. It's been a lifelong interest for me to be an artist.
Yes.
But frankly, I didn't consider the implications of that. But I didn't get a lot of pressure from home. You should be a doctor or something.
Right.
My family couldn't afford to allow me to think that way. I thought I was going to be an artist, and it turned out that I became what I thought I was going to be, for good or bad. But it's been a struggle at times. But
yeah, I'm sure.
I'm considered somewhat successful, and I do have done my work all the time. I have had jobs.
Yeah.
But
like a real job? I'm just kidding.
Well, a lot of part-time jobs. And I put myself through college, Cranbrook, by working in the automobile factories in Flint, Michigan.
Wow.
It was a walk, the major factory, Flint Fisher Body.
Yeah.
Was just a 20-minute walk from home. So I could walk to work and walk back and save money while I was in college by living at home in Flint.
That's how you made it happen.
So it kind of happened that way, and it all worked out. But I didn't really have a plan how I was going to make money at it.
Yeah.
So
were you first generation college for your family, or
Yes, I actually was.
Yeah, yeah. I love that.
First generation.
Yeah.
And I was desperate to get out of Flint. I looked at Chicago, New York, art centers. I wanted to be part of that. But I hadn't even been to New York then. I applied to this small art college in Columbus, Ohio, Columbus College of Art and Design.
Hmm.
And I got a scholarship. And Columbus, Ohio was a huge city to me.
I bet.
Bigger than Flint.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in Columbus for a couple years, and it was more in an advertising kind of curriculum. And I was having a hard time.
Yeah.
Feeling this is not what I want to do.
No.
And
I can't picture you doing
And so I remember I had painting assignment or illustration assignments that I could use as an application for applying to Cranbrook in painting.
Okay.
And I did that, and I got a recommendation from an instructor I had at Columbus College of Art and Design. And lo and behold, I got into Cranbrook.
Wow.
And I was scared to death.
Yeah.
Because I knew they would find out I was a fraud. You know, I was not, I'm not a painter. I was just studying advertising and illustration. But I got into Cranbrook and faked it. And then Cranbrook had one of the best college foundries in the country at that time. Mm. And one of my minors was a sculptor, and I got fascinated with casting and bronze and iron and aluminum and all that. And then I switched to graduate work at Cranbrook. So I was at Cranbrook 4 years.
Yeah.
And I learned foundry and sculpture there. And then immediately afterwards, I moved out to Boston.
Why Boston?
Oh, I followed a girl out. And we got married, but that got me to Boston, at least the East Coast.
Yep.
I knew I couldn't probably break into New York, so Boston was a good size place for me to.
Yeah.
Was that
in the 70s?
That would have been right in 1970.
Okay.
Actually.
Did you find Boston to be kind of a cultural hotspot at the time when you went in there?
Less so, you mean, than...
Now, or...
Was it so different?
I can imagine.
It is so different now.
Yeah.
I end up running into this guy who was setting up what he called the ACT workshop. Act and Crafts Workshop.
Yeah.
And he had found an old Edison building in the south end of Boston. It was huge. It was like five stories. It had this one big room that was ceilings 50, 60 feet high.
Wow.
And he said, if you move out to Boston, you could set up a foundry here. So I moved out partly on that basis. To backtrack a bit.
Yeah.
I first came to Boston. There was a college art teaching conference. Everybody at Cranbrook at the time was looking for teaching jobs. I wasn't really into that, but yeah. I was doing the interviews to get a teaching job. Walking down Newbury Street, and somebody told me about this program that was starting in this South End. And I met this guy named John Weidman, and he said, move out here and you can start a foundry. So I moved out, and then in that first year I had a small foundry going. And that got me into casting, and I made a living casting for other artists for 10 or 15 years. That.
That's incredible. And so that's when you had that space, then the commissions followed, I would assume. Like,
it took a while because I was I was trying to break into the gallery. I really wasn't aware of art commissions or competing for for projects. I didn't know about that. I just thought all I had to do was work hard, try to do good work, and then that would come. And I had some exhibitions in Boston, a couple small galleries in New York. I had shows, but I never made enough to even pay for the materials, the bronze and all, let alone think of it as a career. So I bought a, and I always say it, the best tool I ever bought was one of those small, what's it called, the Mac Plus. It was a, that little cube computer, you know. Mac Plus. And that allowed me to do word processing and write without you going through gallons of whiteout on my.
That's amazing.
Then I started winning some very small art competitions around Boston. And then bit by bit, you know, they got a little bigger, and then it became my career for
a long time.
Quite a long time.
I mean, you're totally downplaying some of the work. Like, you've done some really incredible work in Boston.
I've done some nice projects.
Nice projects.
Fairly large projects. And
the one that people talk about a lot is the bronze frogs in Boston Common.
Oh, yeah. That was an interesting competition. It was a national competition.
Oh, was it really?
And, you know, I was running a foundry then. I felt like I always had a advantage. Because artists have to send their work to a foundry and try to budget that in.
But you owned one.
But I had a foundry. I had three foundries before my last foundry in Medford, and I was making a living casting mostly my work. At some point, I stopped casting for other artists. Artists are kind of difficult to work with.
Oh, really?
I
bet, especially if there's that like lack. I'm guessing there's a lack of control over the process when they give it off to somebody to create.
Lack of control, and it's hard to have a client relationship with people you know.
Right.
They won't want to be part of the process, and that slows things down and all that. But anyway, I tried that for a number of years. But I always felt I have a competitive edge because I can cast my own work. I'm not stuck with the profit margin. I could end up paying myself very little. And still do okay, you know. I was very competitive that way. Because if I offered in my proposals bronze casting, I had a good success rate.
Just a little bit more on that. That was so brave to go out and do like build a your own foundry? Like what? A lot of it's, I just think that's pretty unusual for artists to do that. And so like what gave you the confidence to do that?
Well, it was Cranbrook. Cranbrook had an art instructor, Jewish Schmidt, who probably the most important sculpture instructor who sent their students out. They're capable of building their own equipment. We were always working on handmade furnaces and the shanks, the lifting tools that take metal, hot metal out of the furnace.
Yeah,
just knew how to do it. Maybe not do it well, but I went away feeling
I'm comfortable.
Do I just need a welder now and need some scrap metal? I can do. And often the furnace linings were a 30 or 50 gallon drum, and you just line. There isn't much to them. You need forced air. And my early foundries, I'd go to the Morgan Memorial in Boston, big building that you could get all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember I would buy these Eureka vacuum cleaner blowers.
Yeah.
And you could buy them for a few bucks each. And I'd have a pile of them, and one would burn out.
I'd throw another one in.
And it was just
the education gave you the confidence.
It's like I putter. That's what I call most of my work in my studio now. Is I just go in there and putter until something comes out. And that really started a career that made money, whereas the gallery I could see never worked for me too well.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I want to talk about what you're doing right now, but I don't want to gloss over some of the things in your past. I have a couple questions.
Okay.
And I'm also curious about your opinion on public art and why it's important. And it would be fun to relate it to that Tony Lopes, the retired teacher.
Tony Lopes, oh yeah.
Yeah, yes. And like his, so I'd love for you to tell the story about that connection and then your kind of perspective on public art and why it's important.
Well, Tony Lopes was this retired school teacher from Framingham schools. He gave me a call one day and said he liked my work and would like to get together and maybe have a drink. And this was a phone message.
Yeah.
And I didn't call him right back because it sounded like another one of those waste of my time. But it's nice if people likes your work, but to have to go into town and meet someone for a drink.
Right.
Why not just talk on the phone or something? But anyway, he persisted. He called again and suggested Harvard Square. And then we met at Bartley's Burger. In Harvard Square. You might know it. It's a famous burger place. And he just announced we were having a drink. He said, I have some money. I want to give it to you to do public art. Mm. Anything you want to do anywhere, but it has to be public.
Yeah.
He had been walking around Boston and saw some of my work, and that's how he found me. It wasn't any prior connection that I had established with him.
Yeah.
And what kind of work do we do?
Right.
He had already approached the new ICA with his money, saying, I'll give you some money. He'd already picked me out as somebody he wanted to work with. I'll give you some money to commission David Phillips to do some work for the new ICA. And they said, we'll take the money, but you can't choose the artist for us. So,
and that's an equitable response from the ICA, right?
And so that didn't work out for the ICA, but it worked out for me anyway.
Good.
Because it turned out we both loved animals. He'd adopted some of his cats from Animal Rescue League of Boston, and I like animals, cats especially. And so we just walked into their office and said, we're interested in giving you a gift of sculpture for, has to be seen in the public. They had a dog run area.
Yeah.
We had our eye on that. And could go out in the dog run area, and would you be interested? And I think at first they're in shock when someone does that. And you have to convince them that it's real.
It's real. It's a good thing.
And then that was my first job through Tony.
Yeah.
And it was a piece that was put in. I can't rattle off the years right now, but it was installed, and then Tony died half a year later.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, I was delighted to have gotten a commission that way.
Absolutely.
About, I would say, sometime within a year after he passed, the executor of his estate called me up and said, you know, Tony left more money for you to do more public art. And that's where the New England Conservatory of Music came in. So Tony was a big music lover, theater goer, and again, we approached
the conservatory.
And they listened to us kind of in the same way.
Yeah.
So it just led to all these commissions for the conservatory. So those finished up when I finally moved here. I finished a mobile and the work that you might have seen.
I did see it
earlier at the Open Studio.
Yes.
And
very cool.
That was quite a wonderful run.
That
this kind of thing even happens, you know, is really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Remarkable.
Tell me, that's like we call it a bluebird, right? Like it just kind of came in.
And
wow. And you connected with Tony so well, it sounds like. What an awesome opportunity, that connection that you just never know.
Serendipity. You know, I could never have predicted something like that in my career.
No, I know. It
always was a struggle.
Of course.
At one point, I would be spending probably a third of my time just putting out proposals, and they can take a lot of time, especially if they involve a 3D model, and I would often do that because that's another thing I could do.
Right.
And make models, and realistic models. And I did airplanes, model airplanes when I was a kid, too. So that all ties in.
All ties in. And, that's so cool. Okay, the other cool project that I want to ask you how you got involved in is with the Museum of Science, Live Long and Prosper, with the Nimoy family.
Well, it started out, again, it's my public art out there doing its work.
Yeah.
This painter in Boston, Tom Stocker, he has a studio in the South End. Mm-hmm. And he had, he was fascinated with Leonard Nimoy and his connection with Boston, and the old West End of Boston,
yeah,
where Haymarket and City Hall is now. Mm-hmm. And he felt strongly that there should be some recognition of Leonard Nimoy. He told me that he went to MIT first, and he had proposed a holographic image. I don't know if it was the hand or of a portrait.
Yeah.
But it was too technically difficult. So he has been thinking about this for a number of years before I ever met him. But he walked by this corner piece I had, this pair of violin scrolls at the Conservatory of Music.
Yeah.
And he must have seen it at night, and it was lit from within. He says, "That's the Nimoy statue. I have to find out who this artist is." And again, he called me up.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're interested in this, but I want to do a memorial to Leonard Nimoy. I think my first question was, what's the budget?
Right.
Oh, there's no money yet. Well, where would the site be?
We
have no site. Yeah. And I said, well, okay.
Right.
I'll do some sketches. And he's going to do the footwork to start looking for sites.
Yeah.
And he found this one site closer to Leonard Nimoy's neighborhood, and that fell through. And then he talked about three or four other sites, and Museum of Science came up. And so we approached, before we approached the Museum of Science, I had to kind of refine. I'd done some rough sketches. I had to refine, you know, what is it I want to make, or what might be a good proposal. So I proceeded to do a clay model. It got very involved, to make a long story short. And finally, the Museum of Science says, okay, on Leonard Nimoy's birthday, we would like to announce a fundraiser. This was almost 3 years ago. But for the fundraiser, we need a budget. What do you think it'll cost? At that time, I was proposing a 25-foot-high sculpture in stainless steel, all cast, none of which I could have ever done in my own foundry. But this is huge work.
Yeah.
And so they needed a budget. And so I called around the country, and the deadline was so tight, like three weeks or 4 weeks to finish up my model, get it out to a foundry for just a rough quote. And only one foundry that I called would do it, and it was out in Oregon. So
yeah.
Finally it came in just a day or two before
they
announced it. So they announced a fundraiser. That's been going on for 2.5 years,
wow. The
fundraiser.
Is it expensive?
Well, the quote I got was 600 to 900,000 for the casting alone.
Wow. That's a lot. Wow.
It's a lot. The fundraiser needs to, you know, it's a chunk of money. When you think of the Martin Luther King, it started out at, I think, 500 or 5 million and ended up at 11 million.
The Embrace.
Yeah, The Embrace, yeah.
Yeah.
And
what do you think of that piece?
I think it's technically good, and bravo to the young artists that got it.
Yeah.
I think a little more abstract somehow. would have been better than, you know, the bracelets and trinkets and all the stuff.
The detailed stuff. Yeah.
It's an odd way of portraying two figures together based on a snapshot in time.
Mm-hmm.
Too literal. I think too literal.
Yeah. That's so interesting. The one thing I do like about it. Well, I like that everyone's talking about it when it. You know, it's always fun to pull apart other people's work. Right? Yeah. But I loved seeing my kids run underneath it. And when you're under it, it does feel it has that abstract feel where it could be anything, you know. But you know that there's a significant meaning to it all. But I love being underneath it and seeing the kids run underneath.
Those are good points.
Good elements.
It's so massive. It's so interactive. Massive.
Yeah.
On a level.
Yeah. So tell me, why do you think public art is important?
I think people walk, just from my own work.
Yeah.
I occasionally get people who I've never met. Usually have a bronze plaque with my name, and they can look me up.
Yeah.
And just out of the blue, I get, oh, we walked by such and such a work, and we really enjoyed it. And they'll ask some. I think when you're in public art, you have this audience that are part of everyday experience for them,
mm-hmm.
and they may not even know your name, but I know it's out there. Working, they walk by it, they like it or dislike it or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's so different than a captive audience in a museum show or you walk into a gallery. That captive audience, everybody's looking at your reaction to the work, and if the artists are there, they're hoping, you know.
Yeah.
There's none of that. Pressure on the audience or on the sculptor, me.
Right. When
I just know it's out there working, and I have gotten work from previous work, so I know it's out there working at some level.
Yeah.
You know.
That's so interesting because public art, like you said, it's for the people, it's for everyone, and sometimes it's people's first introduction to art.
Right, exactly.
And so having it in places, it's so important. So let's talk a little bit about where we are today. And so today we're in Sandwich.
Sandwich.
It's stunning here. So tell me about your connection to Cape Cod.
Well, when I first moved to Boston before I met Peggy, I came down to the Cape. I was actually a little disappointed in it because I like stones. I mean, there's not big, you know, massive stone beaches like are up in Maine. I'd also been going up to Maine. And coming from Flint, Michigan, which is landlocked, there weren't that many stones as a kid that I saw, except, you know, of course, there's stones in the ground. Right. I remember this oil truck. We lived on a dirt road. This oil truck would come by, oil the roads, and then all these dusty stones that were out in the road, suddenly you could see all the patterns and the lines in them. And I would pick those up.
Yeah.
But then when the oil or the dust got back on the stones, they disappeared. So coming out to the East Coast, I would go to the beaches and collect stones. And Cape Cod does have some stone beaches, like Sandwich has some good ones.
Yeah.
Sandy Neck and
yeah.
what's right in Sandwich, down by the marina.
Oh, yeah.
They have
Lots of rocks.
Good rocks there. But Peggy and I had when we met about 26 years ago, she told me about this little cottage on Thomas Hill in Truro that some friends of hers were renting and would, I'd like to go down and see it. I said, okay. And it was this summer cottage that the landlady's father, and the landlady at that time was early 80s.
Yeah.
And her father had built it as a mail order summer cabin.
Oh,
it was
wow.
called. It was shipped out on the railroad and dropped off at Pamet Harbor, I think. And then he assembled it all, and that's unwinterized, but it had the
enough stuff.
$10 million view.
Oh.
We found out the price of the cottage when it was bought new. I think it was like $300. This is going back far enough where I guess that was some real money, but
it's all relative.
So that was the cottage, and we ended up renting mostly in August. For just 20 years, that as our vacation spot, and I was collecting stones and barnacles and everything, and I had a small one-car garage the landlady had been using as for storage, and I used that as my studio when I came down, and also I was working on public art all that time, and I'd take the fast ferry back and forth. Sometimes it'd be Friday night I'd get in, Peggy'd pick me up down in P-Town and then drop me off first thing in the morning. I'd go back. And many years like that, we were down to the Cape.
That's incredible.
Enjoying it. You know?
And you spent some time in the Dune Shacks?
Yes, we did.
Which I'm like so impressed that Peggy would do that.
Well, that's my kind of girl. Yeah, no kidding.
Right.
If you don't know, the
Dune Shack has no electricity, no running water. Right. It's all like a pump and
an outhouse. Usually. And some of them have kind of a solar shower.
Yes.
But others, you pump out this rusty looking water to shower with.
Yeah.
You cook on a propane stove, and you have a propane cooler that's no bigger than beer ice chest.
Yeah.
And you take everything that's going to last 7 days in with you.
Yeah.
And they drop you off and pick you up at the end of that period. And we loved it. Did it 5 times and 4 different dune shack.
Lots of spiders, I've heard.
Seascape was our first one.
Okay.
And we got a week in October that was right after a hurricane moving through. It rained the whole time. Rained the whole time. And the wind was shaking this dune shack called Seascape.
Wow.
And
well, luckily, you like each other, so she must have been like, good, now you can just chill.
Yeah, when can we do it again?
All right, yeah, when can we do it again?
Well, that first, I think it was the first one, it had a wood-burning stove that part of the hinge system and the door was broken.
Yeah.
And I said, I'll fix it. I'll take it with me, bring it back. I'll fix it.
Yeah.
And I think that act helped us to get some of the next ones that we got.
Oh, good.
Because we continued to the first one we applied to was just this random lottery kind of thing. And there were times when they would call us up and said, you were on an alternate list. Can you go? people would bail out for one reason or another. And sometimes it was only 3 days' notice, but we would take it because we valued it so much. You know.
What did you get out of it as from being an artist?
I did some sketching and photography. I didn't really do my sculpture work because it takes tools and equipment.
Right.
But just the environment, the silence, the solitude in nature, reflective time. There's not much else you can do but think good thoughts, I think. So you're in this environment. The beach is nearby.
Yeah.
You go beachcombing. The wind blows. I remember the mornings we get up. The wind is blowing at night, all night. And in the evening before, say, a storm or the wind is hard, there'd be all these tracks on the sand.
Yeah.
And the wind would blow them away before, they're all gone when we go to bed.
Yeah.
We get up in the morning and all new tracks all around.
Oh my gosh.
Including deer tracks and
and
I think there are occasionally coyote, rabbits, all kinds of tracks. So all this activity going on around.
Yeah, all the nature.
At night, yeah.
Yeah, that's very cool. So tell me what has it been like to kind of, you don't have the foundries in Boston or the Boston area any longer, and now you've really committed to your practice here in a fairly large, very full, very busy, very organized studio.
That's because I knew you were coming.
Artists always tell us that when we come into the studio, they're like,
"It's true,
yeah,
I'm sure."
It's always like this, not really, but it's really you can tell like you're busy and but it's definitely a much smaller scale now. So tell me about what are you focused on now, and what has it been like to come to the Cape as a full time artist?
Well. I must say I miss some of my equipment because I think of the tools that one has as an artist are where your ideas come from. You don't, for instance, propose a project back when I had the foundry and all those tools. I proposed projects that were doable from my perspective, mm-hmm. And that included all my tools, gave me I could do this idea, I could do that idea. I don't have to shop too much of it out or none of them out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm taking this studio, this new space, smaller space, the same. I can still weld. I have woodworking tools, grinding tools. I have an air compressor, but it's all very condensed from what I had before. So the ideas are smaller, but to me, in some ways, it's more exciting to be thinking this way.
Yeah.
A proposal, it's the joke that public artists have is the fun part is making the proposal and getting the idea, and then you have to then do the damn thing.
Got to figure it out.
Yeah, you have to do it now.
I can relate to that with projects.
Yeah.
I like the idea of it.
Yeah.
It's the chase.
So now I'm hoping that
Do you feel like you're starting over?
In some sense, yeah.
It's
like a new lease on my creativity.
Yeah.
Even though I was with Boston Sculptors Gallery and I would, I'm doing all these public art commissions and busy with that career, I would work for, I did several shows there, work for a show, and have that going on at the same time, but it was always a fragmented kind of work habits that I had, and now it can be more focused, and I think I'm getting I'm getting a new energy going here, but I still have all kinds of ideas, putting the stuff that I'm doing around me together, and what else do I do with it? One of the things I'm excited about over here, you see this piece on the wall.
Yes.
And that's Braille inlaid into a stone. And I have two big volumes of Braille, Emily Dickinson and Robert Frost. And I want to, there are a bunch of these fragments down by over there too.
Yeah.
And I want to do a wall piece.
Yeah.
These are off our stone wall here.
Yeah.
Fragment. And I want to do a wall piece of Robert Frost poetry in Braille and call it Mending Wall, and have these stones all connecting up like this.
Yeah.
You know, corners to corners, kind of a meandering, and call the piece Mending Wall. And then Emily Dickinson has some really great poetry, too, that I have the Braille for.
Yeah.
But this idea of language, they also look like Dead Sea Scroll tablets or something.
Yeah, but they do.
They're a language.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be interesting to have a show somewhere of Braille on the wall. Sighted people would look at them like we're looking at them.
Right.
I can't even read that.
Right.
But if you could invite some blind people intermingling.
Yes.
And watch the different reaction of touching and seeing.
Absolutely.
And it make an interesting juxtaposition of how people perceive artwork. So that's an idea that I think would be neat to
it's beautiful.
Pursue somehow.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. It's like you're addressing accessibility and combining, you know, seeing and you know, it's incredible texture. It's really, the piece, we'll post a photo of what we're talking about. You know, the piece is a very, looks like a very raw rock with, or stone, I mean, with the Braille covering just a portion of it. It's beautiful.
The Braille is all white. And so I take different colors of pastels.
Yeah.
And then just with fingers rub. And Braille being two-sided, it'll give you a series of small dots.
Yes.
And then where the little bump is, it'll catch the pastel or charcoal, whatever I'm using, and leave a little white circle around there if you don't rub down too hard. And it kind of small dots, bigger circles. It's very complex look to it.
Yeah, it's very cool. I love that whole concept. Has it been, you and I have, we're so lucky. I'm so lucky that we have mutual friends that connected us. And we
Pam
met,
and Paul.
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah. And they introduced us at a Christmas or a holiday party a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to you and going home and then like Googling you. And I was like, oh my God, we're so lucky to have this person on Cape Cod with us now.
That's very nice.
So
I feel welcomed.
Oh, good, good. And so how can we, you know, other artists need to see this. I mean, people need to see what you're doing in here. What could we do better here on the Cape that would make it more welcoming, like the Boston scene was for you? Like, what could we do here? Any advice or suggestions?
Studio, like organized studio visits might be good.
I mean,
the the studio visit you came to, I did it, and Peggy and I did it. Peggy did all the work for that. But we did it in two parts. One was mainly to, our neighbors were curious, what's going on in this?
What does that guy do?
And then the other was just more open invitation. I think that's the one you got.
Yes.
And so it brought a lot of people through.
Yep.
Not necessarily a focused group that's interested in art, but
yeah,
people that are curious and
very.
They ask a lot of interesting questions, and often they ask no questions because what do you ask about all this stuff? It's like clutter, all this stuff.
Organized though.
But it would be nice to maybe bring in some kind of a more focused group.
Yeah.
I don't know. I see you have a recent mentor that you published on your website. This young guy who's, I think he's into music. I don't know. I don't think I can run classes out of here, but it would be nice to have
more interaction.
Some kind of groups. I'd be happy to kind of show some groups through.
Yeah.
And I went to that one in Wellfleet. This
Robert Henry.
Robert Henry.
He's 90. And he's still working.
Still going.
Still going, you know. It's so interesting. One last question, and then I'll pause us and we can walk around. Any words of wisdom to somebody who wants to get into public art?
You have to start out small and work your way up. My first public art commission, And I had a sand foundry at the time. They were laying a new brick sidewalk in Chelsea, Mass. And I proposed this little square, a bunch of them, little square bronzes the size of a half a brick.
Yeah.
That when the bricklayers were going along,
yeah,
would just lay them in as part of their brick lane.
Perfect.
And it was crabs. So all these crabs crawling over the side. That was my first public art project. And
it was digestible, right? Like for the people to implement the idea.
Yeah, well, the bricklayers.
Yeah. Did they love
it? They became my workforce after I cast these lugs off the bottom.
Yeah.
So they just put the mortar in and sink them in and trim it up around the edges.
Yeah.
So they got all these crabs crawling on the sidewalk.
That's so cool.
But it happens incrementally. But with public art, I think it's hard to think big from the beginning because you're involving a committee, and the committee doesn't want to bet on somebody who doesn't appear to have done anything beyond a certain scale.
Okay.
So
yeah.
I worked myself up.
Yep.
And I could keep proposing something bigger, and I had that as a reference to
keep going. That's such great advice because, as you know, public art is it's very in the conversation in the art sector now. Everybody wants public art. It's very difficult. I get calls every week at the Arts Foundation.
I bet people
want to do public art, and, you know, each town has their own regulations, and there's not enough money for public art. You have a lot of artists who somewhat inexperienced, and so it's a big commitment.
They might have great ideas, but the idea is,
work your way up.
It's hard to me for me to say this, but
yeah,
good ideas are kind of cheap.
Yep.
And they don't count in the end if you keep them to yourself. You know,
so right.
you have to find a way to convince people through the physical world, you know.
Yeah.
Something tangible.
Yep.
And sculptures, although public art today is getting into performance,
yes.
and all kinds of different things. Mm-hmm. But still, you have to have some skills, music, dancing, or whatever the public art is.
Yeah.
You have to develop those skills,
yep.
Before you can do it.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you for having us.
You're
today.
Welcome.
I can't wait to go for this tour.
Okay, let's go.
Hosted by Arts Foundation's Executive Director, Julie Wake, the series is an ode to the artistic process and its unique manifestation on Cape Cod and beyond. Thanks for listening.